Hello, everybody. This is Noreen, and you're listening to Defy and Hustle Radio tonight. Thank you very much for being with us. I love that song. That's Clocks by Coldplay, but that's a song I love the way it starts. It just sort of comes in and it takes you along. So I always like the songs we're playing at the beginning, and I never want to cut them off. Everybody's like, cut it off, start speaking. But I'm like, oh, the song's known all over the world, and I like it. So I let people try and enjoy it for a little bit. I am here in the studio with my favorite co-host, Kelly Trepanier. Welcome, Kelly.
Hi, everybody.
And then,
it's always good to be here.
Also, we have here our producer, Bob Small. Thank you, Bob.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we have a great show for you today.
Really excited about this guest.
Yes, very excited about this guest. And she's about to start her roadshow to promote her most recent book. But she is the Jane Green from Westport, Connecticut, not originally, but that's where she's been for a long time. Jane Green is the author of 20 novels, including 17 New York Times bestsellers. She's has over 10 million books in print and is published in 25 languages. And she has several books in development for film and TV, which we'll find out more about. Her latest book is called The Friends We Keep. So I want everybody to listen very closely tonight as we have the honor of speaking with Jane Green. Welcome, Jane.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So we were just talking to you while we were trying to get set up here. And so this is your 21st
yeah.
book?
No, it's the 20th. But
okay,
I'm writing my 21st right now. So my numbers are getting confused in my own head. But yes, The Friends We Keep is my 20th.
And so I want to get into the book, The Friends We Keep, but you're saying you're writing your 21st one. Are you always writing one book and publishing one at the same time?
Often. Let me just say this. No, well, it's unusual to have this sort of career without working enormously hard. So it's very unusual for me not to be writing whatever else I'm doing.
And so you live in Westport, Connecticut.
Yes.
And you're married with 6 children?
Yes. So it's complicated, but in the best way that modern families are complicated. I have 4 children. My husband has 2, and all of them live here, although the eldest is now living in London. She's working and living in London. So,
and London's originally where you're from, right?
That is where I'm from, yes. Yes. But my husband's a Westporter, so we're a good blend.
You must be, because something's working out very nicely for you. So so let's talk for a moment about The Friends We Keep and what inspired you to write about The Friends We Keep. Why don't you give our listeners a little background? And then I want to ask you some questions, because I love writers and I love to hear about what goes into your process. So why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So The Friends We Keep is the story of 3 people who meet at university in the UK in the 1980s, and they end up living together and they form this extraordinary friendship and vow that they will be best friends forever and ever. But of course, life gets in the way, and they each go off their separate ways, and 2 of them come to America and 1 stays in the UK, and they lose touch over the years. And suddenly they find themselves at their 30th reunion, and for whatever reason, they're all on their own again, and they come together and say, well, rather than going into the next part of life on our own, why don't we live together again? So, of course, they end up living together in this sort of modern commune, but they each have secrets from the past, and one of those secrets is a very large and dark one that involves all of them. And, of course, once they live together, it's inevitable that the secrets will come out, and this utopia, this newfound utopia, is about to blow up. So that is the story of The Friends We Keep. And you asked about the inspiration. I have to be really honest, as a 51-year-old woman living in Westport, Connecticut, I have found myself much, I'm leading a life that, it's a wonderful life, and I have a lot of friends, and yet I find that I feel much more isolated than I ever expected. I am more isolated than I ever expected, and partly I blame technology. I think we're all so busy hiding behind our computer screens and our phones that we've forgotten how to connect. You know, we text rather than pick up the phone.
For
and
sure.
Everyone's so busy, and we don't see even the people we love most in the world. But I, my husband and I, every time we go out for dinner with friends, we find ourselves having the same conversation, which goes along the lines of, you know, we're all going to be empty nesters soon. Wouldn't it be amazing if we bought a farm somewhere or a piece of land and we all lived together? We had our own little houses, like a tiny house for each of us, and then a communal barn with a kitchen and a living room, and everybody we speak to, this is coming up with everyone, and we're all saying this would be amazing. And I'm thinking, gosh, the afternoon of life is about to be here, and I don't really want to go into it on my own. And rather than diving in real life, why don't I write a book about it first? and then let's see where that takes me. So my book is very much art imitating the fantasy of my life.
It's funny you say that, because it's true. So I'm 53, and we were friends of ours, my man and another couple and another friend, we went on a boat in February around on a sailboat around the island of Tortola. And after we were done, we were like, wouldn't it be nice to just get a place close enough to each other? It's funny that it usually also has farming qualities or some simplicity about it that I think people are longing for, especially as you get to a certain point in your life where you realize, oh, wait a minute, maybe all that striving and materialism, it was fun while it lasted, and we're not trying to make it sound negative, but there's this, I think, a longing for reconnection and simplicity and less materialism and more. Yeah.
Well, I'm in a different stage of my life, and that's my biggest yearning. And I always find it fascinating when I call friends, they're, oh, what's wrong? What's going on? And it's just, oh, no one calls anymore. What are you doing? And I was even hanging out with friends this past weekend, and we had been outside and had finally gotten back home, and then they flipped on the TV, and then they both got their iPhones and iPads out and were like playing games and texting people and watching the TV. And I was like, and no one was talking. And I was like, this is so weird. I'm going to go.
Bye. Everybody's staring into their electronics.
But so anyway.
Well, I just want to add on to that what's so fascinating is that as human beings, we are built to connect, and we long for connection. Everything is about connection. And actually, you need, you know, when you're stuck behind a screen, you're not generating oxytocin. And oxytocin is the thing that allows you to empathize with other people. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that we do connect. Gloria Steinem says, where she has this wonderful quote where she says, we're communal animals as human beings. We can't function all by ourselves. There's a reason why solitary confinement is torture. But we're also creatures of habit, and technology is so addictive, and we've become habituated to hide behind our screens. So I'm hoping to spark some inspiration, perhaps, in people's lives with the friends we keep, because none of us want to go into the next part of our lives alone, and there's no reason why we have to.
I want to ask you a question about something in this book, too. You're talking about secrets, and it is interesting that we also, as humans, feel like we have to put on a mask about the way we live. And there's, if you do look at technology and social media, there's a perfection to all the photos you see. So I know you have to have intrigue in your book, but was it something you were seeing in your real life about people who have one face for the public and something else going on behind the scenes?
Oh, well, I see that everywhere. And I even, you know, I have a number of author friends who have very glamorous, you know, we all have quite glamorous Instagrams. And we sort of laugh about the ridiculousness of how we push the piles to one side when we take the pictures of our kitchens, you know, all the piles of the mail and the catalogs and the things we haven't got to are very deliberately moved out of the frame. You know, Brené Brown, the writer and social worker, she talks about the importance of vulnerability and how shame is what makes us put up those constructs and we want people to see, we don't want anybody to see that none of us feel adequate. We all feel insecure. But in fact, the only way that we can truly connect with other human beings is to allow those vulnerabilities to show. And I have to just tell you, I was invited out for lunch recently with a girl in my town who's one of the, and I feel ridiculous saying this at my age, but she's one of the popular girls. She's quite a bit younger than me, gorgeous, you know, skinny, beautiful, designer clothes clad. I mean, this girl just has everything. And we went out for lunch, and just over lunch, she started telling me about her life and her business. And it transpired that nothing was as it seemed, and that she and her family were struggling, just like the rest of us are struggling. And I was so moved by her honesty, actually. And what it does, when people are honest about their own flaws and their struggles, it makes all of us feel okay about ourselves, because we're all struggling. Everybody is having a hard time in some way or other. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we can be honest instead of hiding behind this perfect facade, the better it is for all. I mean, that's human. That's what allows our humanity to come through.
Absolutely. That authentic communication, authentically being yourself, to be able to do that, you're demonstrating love and acceptance to yourself. And when all that love comes into you and you just say, it's okay to be who I am, where I am, how I'm feeling, whatever's going on in this moment, gives everyone, as you just said, that permission to do the same.
But easier said than done sometimes, because even though you're aware of it, which is the first key, is to even be aware that you're feeling a certain way instead of like blaming somebody else or something like that. It's still, you still have to go through allowing it to come up and figuring out how to deal with it. And so we're all getting some good practice at learning to deal with maybe emotions we would have either didn't know were there or have repressed in the past. So I think the whole society across the globe is getting a good dosage of that right now. You talk about struggle. And so in the name of our show is Defy and Hustle. And I know when you spoke with Kelly, she was asking you about how you went into writing novels, and you had a career, and you had been part of the ABC News team. You've had your own radio show, but you were working more as a journalist, correct?
Yes, I was a journalist. Yeah, in London, I was a journalist for years. And I left my job at 27 to write a book and get a publishing deal. And I gave myself 3 months, which is ridiculous, and I wouldn't advise anybody to do the same.
I was going to ask, did you start the book before you quit, or you were just like, no, I'm quitting, peace out?
I just decided that I'd give myself 3 months and I'd start a book. And as it happens, about 2 days before that 3 month period was up, there was a bidding war for my first novel, and that was it. My life was changed. That was 24 years ago now. And so I, you know, on the one hand, I had it incredibly easy. I was so lucky. My first book went straight on the bestseller list. That was in the UK. And then I had a book come out in America called Jemima J, which has sold millions and you know, is probably still my biggest selling book to date. It was a huge success. So I was enormously lucky, but you know, nobody stays at the top forever. That trajectory has to change. And so I definitely had my ups and downs throughout my career, and sometimes it's been really hard. And you know, there have been times when I've watched my numbers dip, you know, frighteningly, and I've had to shift my focus completely on what's important and what I need to do. Actually, I mean, really, a few years ago when I hit the real dip, I realized that I needed to stop worrying about the bestseller list and stop worrying about the numbers and stop worrying about
what
the book
would
do. Yes.
You do.
Every author, you have to today, because you're actually, the truth is, you're only, publishing is in such a state of flux and technology has changed everything and nobody quite knows what the future holds or what to do now. And because the publishers are all, you know, desperately trying to make money, because books are not selling in the numbers in any way, shape or form like they used to. And so they're throwing out more and more books and sort of flinging them at the wall and hoping that some of them stick. And
content.
Some of them do.
Yeah.
It's content. There is so much content. And it's not like the old days where you had a team that took real ownership of your book and built up a campaign over months and months. And you know, now everybody's completely overworked because they're putting out so much content. And it's pretty frightening. But mm-hmm. what I realized was my focus had to be not on what this book would do, but on writing the best book I possibly could, because the work will always speak for itself. And if you really focus on doing the absolute best work you can, that's the important thing.
Do you have a voice? So you're sitting there writing the book and you come up with new characters each time, correct?
I do, yes.
So you go to write the book and you come up with the whole idea and how the story's going to end, or do you just develop? I know I read a book called On Writing by Stephen King, and he was talking about something he recommends to authors, which was developing your characters and developing a situation or maybe a few situations, but not creating the ending, because by creating the ending and trying to force the characters to go down a certain path, you're negating the way the characters might truly behave in real life. So I'm curious, like, when you're going and when you're writing, do you how do you do that? And also, do you have a voice in your head that goes, oh my God, this is great, or this is terrible, this sucks, I got to start again, or, you know, what goes on?
So first of all, I have to say that On Writing by Stephen King is one of the greatest books that has ever been written about, you know, for writers. It's just wonderful. And he's absolutely right. The real work has to go into the characters because the characters will always dictate the story. However, mm-hmm. having said that, for years and years, that was exactly how I did it. I had a rough story arc, and I knew the message. I sort of knew roughly the story and how it was going to end, but I always allowed my characters to tell their own stories. And what that results in are sort of quite gentle character-driven plots, which, you know, The Beach House, for example, was all about these characters, a bunch of people living on Nantucket or spending a summer on Nantucket. But the characters end up telling their own stories. However, because of the changing face of publishing, I'm finding that now I'm thinking much more about film and TV. And so really, you know, what in an ideal world, you want the books you write to be interesting to film and TV people. And so they have to be a little higher concept. And actually, the book that I'm writing now, which is my 21st novel, I'm writing in a very different way. And I wrote a 20-page treatment before I even sat down to start the novel. And the treatment breaks down the novel into themes. And I have to say, I'm quite loving it. And I still leave room for my characters, because you never quite know what your characters are going to do. And there's always room for my characters to do things differently, but I'm loving working from a template. It just makes it easier. I've mapped it out, and I'm finding that I'm enjoying the writing process so much more as a result.
And you, when you're saying you want to work with film and TV, or that's where a lot of authors are going now, correct? Because the markets in film and TV have broken open. So are you aligned with somebody, let's say in Hollywood, or it could be in New York City, that is a screenplay writer that might be guiding you on how to write so that it could be easily converted to a screenplay? Or how does it work?
You must have some inside information here, because as it happens, I changed agents last year, and the agent that I chose, he's called Shane Salerno, and his company is the Story Factory in Los Angeles. And he, one of the things that I absolutely loved about him was that he is also a screenwriter, and he wrote the screenplays for Shaft and for Armageddon, and he's writing the next four Avatar movies for Jim Cameron. Yeah, so he's an incredibly accomplished screenwriter, and I have to say it has transformed the way I write, and brainstorming with him has been joyous. I mean, it's just wonderful, because he understands story and movies, you know, because writing for movies is quite a different thing, and I feel like I kind of have the best balance with this book, because I'm writing it as I've written all my novels, and it's still very character-driven, but it's structured as a screenplay.
So what would that... I'm curious, just so what is that... What's different about the way you approach it? I know you said you have a treatment, and you step into it that way with it more, I guess, designed up front, a template. But what else goes into it?
Well, it is really... It's really the structure. So, you know, it's a traditional Greek three-act structure, and at the end of every act, there's a dramatic plot point that spins you into the next act. So it's really that is the most important thing. But I have to say as well, perhaps because of the treatment, the only other book that I did this with was Jemima Jay. And when I wrote Jemima Jay, I flew to Los Angeles to do all the research, and I was planning to write there. I was going to spend a few months there writing, but I...
For Jemima, for this new book.
For Jemima Jay. This
is a long time ago.
Yeah, and this was, you know, computers were brand new, and I bought a computer, and it promptly broke. And I took it to the service shop, and it was going to be in for weeks. And so I had nothing to do in L.A., so I'd go to a little deli or a coffee shop with a notepad, and I outlined the entire book. Because I've done the same thing with this new book now, what I found in both times is that it's been very, very visual. So when I'm actually writing, it's almost unfolding as if I'm watching this on a screen. It feels like I'm watching a movie.
Yeah, I mean, even the way you talk about it, I love listening to artists, because it's, you know, the depth and the dimensions of how you even just speak of your characters, and then allowing them the space to have their own freedom. Like, so as you're writing, you never know what the characters are actually going to do, which I don't know, that to me gets so exciting, because they do become these entities. And you often even hear actors speaking like their characters, they really just become these people. And then you get to also meet them while you're creating them. And it just is a fun dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Most of the time, I think that I have the greatest job in the world. I really do. I mean, I just adore sitting for a few hours a day and losing myself in my imagination. And I get to be mum as well. I also get to dictate my own, you know, I've always had something that defined me as something other than someone's mother. I'm always around for my kids. I've always been able to be around for them. So I'm enormously lucky.
So now you have these kids, but we were talking about you're going out on a roadshow, right? So you put out The Friends We Keep, and that's available. We might as well tell our audience, we're talking to Jane Green, and she's the author of 20 books, and we'll get to your famous essay, but she's just published, right? It's been published, The Friends We Keep, or it's about
coming
to be
out
any day.
Coming out tomorrow.
Out June the 4th.
And you'll be on the Today Show tomorrow.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. By the time this airs, it'll be Tuesday. Sorry, folks. We're doing this. Jane's got a busy schedule, so we're doing the show on Monday, but our show will run on Wednesday. So you're going on the Today Show Tuesday. And talk to me about going on a road show. So you put the book out, and your agent says, your PR company
well,
says
the publisher.
Okay, it's the publisher.
The publisher will, and not for everyone, by the way. This is, you know, again, this is where I'm very lucky because my publisher is still willing to spend the money to set me out on tour. Because I, you know, many people are finding that their tours are being cut or they're not doing so many events. But
why?
I'm going,
you're lucrative. That's why,
money,
right?
Because it's money. Because of the cost.
But yeah, you make money. Money. You have a following. You're just like popular.
I do.
Yes. Good for you, Jane.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Good. And so I'm going out. I'm not doing the West Coast this year. I'm going to save that for next year because my next book is set on the West Coast. So it's really East Coast. And I go out and I do events. It used to be primarily bookstores, libraries. Now I still do a handful of libraries, but I tend to do ticketed events rather than bookstore events. And one of the things that I absolutely love about being on tour is that writing is such an isolating job. I mean, it's, you know, I'm on my own all the time. It's very hard for me to see how my books impact other people. Of course, I could go online and read the reviews, but I try not to because I forget all the good ones and carry the bad ones forever and ever.
Do you?
So
okay.
I try, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So I try and avoid that. But just going out there and meeting the people that read and love my books and people that love books, actually, is wonderful. It means so much to me to meet my readers.
People don't read anymore. Many people, I know, I love reading. I mean, I love reading. Oh, so it is interesting that people, it bothers me that you can write something and it's something cohesive and intelligent often needs to be longer, but you can't keep the attention of people now because they're like off to the next picture that they see. It's not even a writing material many times.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of even writing blogs, and even if they are longer article pieces, are written for people to skim. You know, how to get these big points across that they can just glaze their eyes through and get on to the next one.
Yeah.
I get it. I mean, I'm a huge reader. I became a writer because I was a reader. I was a child who always felt I was very shy, and I the place that I found my comfort and my joy was within the pages of books. So I was always buried in books, continued to be a huge reader, and yet the last few months, Amazon and Netflix and HBO, you know, they've all sort of pulled me in, and I've found myself binge-watching series and instead of reading. And all of a sudden, you know, a week becomes 2 weeks, becomes a month, and you realize you haven't been able to concentrate on a book. So I understand. It's hard that we are so overstimulated now, and our attention spans are so short. You have to really commit to a book. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I am, you know, on the Today Show, I talked about my summer picks, and I had to whiz through 6 books. I actually went through a few more, but I got right back into reading again, and it was just a joy to spend my days just reading again.
The New York Times puts something out each day that I think it's every day, but they put out their top picks, right? It's just summer reads maybe, but I get the New York Times delivered in a brief to my inbox, and so I can skim through the stories. But I notice at the bottom of the major stories, and my God, are there major stories nowadays? But as you get towards the bottom where things mellow out, they get into cooking and they get into reading, which is comforting. But it's hard to read. They'll recommend 6 books. And yeah, you're right. It's like, oh my God, how am I going to read 6 books?
Yeah.
When I go to Barnes & Noble or even if you go online and they start recommending new books, you're like, I want to read them all. And then I sometimes get intimidated and don't choose any get overwhelmed is the word.
Yes, we get overwhelmed. And I have to tell you, if you saw my nightstand right now, you would be horrified.
I'd be thrilled.
It's just piles and piles. Well, yes, but they're all books that I want to read. And the problem is that the pile just keeps getting added to. But yes. I'm actually looking at it. It's very large.
You, we're going to keep going? All right. Sorry. We will take a break. All right, Jane, can you hang in there while we take a quick break?
Oh. Of course.
We're talking, folks, we're talking with Jane Green. She is the famous and lucrative, she acknowledged it, lucrative author. She's making money for her companies that she's working with. So she's about to start her roadshow to promote her latest book, her 20th book, known as The Friends We Keep. So stick around. We're coming right back with Jane Green. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Defiant Hustle Radio. This is Noreen Ehrlich. And, of course, we have Kelly Trepanier here with me.
Hello, everybody.
And, of course, Bob Smalls back there playing Coldplay. So we put on Coldplay because that's a British band. And we have somebody who's a famous. She's originally, you are British. I guess you're not just originally British.
I'm still British.
You're still British. Jane Green.
I'm a naturalized American, so I'm a half and half.
Do you go back and forth? You still have
too many children, too much work, but I don't go back. I completely live here in Connecticut, but I do get to go home usually about once a year, and this year I have to just boast because I'm such a proud mama. My son Harry, who is a rower, is rowing in the Henley Royal Regatta.
Oh wow!
So he and his university boat are going over for Henley. So I'll be going back home in July. I'm very excited.
Congratulations!
You go, Harry.
I was curious. Yeah. So you had been living in London for around 30, 31 years. You quit your job around 27 to become a novelist and published author. When did you end up moving here to Connecticut? How did that happen?
My first husband is American, and we were living in London, and my mother-in-law spent a day driving me around Westchester trying to lure me back to America, and it just didn't feel like me. Not that it wasn't beautiful, but at the end of the day, she said, I think I had a vision of living in a small New England town. And at the end of the day, she suddenly went, oh, I think you'll like Westport, Connecticut. And that was it. She drove me up to Westport. And I got out on Main Street.
You her voice.
I know. And we got out on Main Street and I said, oh, yes, this is it. I could live here. So we moved here. Goodness, we moved here 18 and a half years ago. And that was it.
And Westport has a lot of artists, right, of various types. They have the Westport Playhouse, but you probably know more about the background of Westport, but isn't that a place that attracted artists, writers, musicians?
Yes, it was. Traditionally, that was definitely a huge part of the appeal, that it has this incredible history and legacy of creative people living here, from writers Robert Ludlum was here to musicians, Michael Bolton, to actors Paul Newman, all kinds of really interesting people. A lot of ad agency people and New Yorker illustrators lived here in the 40s and 50s. I will say, even in the 18 years I've been here, I've seen a tremendous change. And I'm married. My husband now, who is not the same husband that I had when I moved here, but my husband is a Westporter. He grew up here. He talks about the town as it was when he grew up. It really was a small New England country town. It's become much more, it feels more New York, and definitely there's a big influx of people from New York and the financial, you know, the financial people have come in. So the character of the town is definitely, it's definitely changing. And yet what's so fascinating about it is there are so many different sides of Westport that you can never pigeonhole it, because it's just when you think you know it, you'll discover another side of Westport. And whether it's the kind of old Italian blue-collar Westport from the Saugatuck area, which is wonderful, to the hedge fund people, to the creative people, there are just so many different sides of Westport. It's a very difficult town to categorize, and it's one of the reasons why I love it so much.
So where do you go to write, and how do you manage? So that the show is Defying Hustle. You must be defying something. Like, do you feel guilty that you're not taking care of your kids because you're writing so much, or how does it go?
Oh, dear. What am I defying? Well, the hustling bit I've got down. That's pretty easy for me, because that's in my nature. And part of being an author today requires a tremendous amount of hustle. But the defying bit, I'm not so sure. I don't feel guilty now. I think I had some guilt when they were younger, but it was guilt and anger at the public school systems here, because they're all, and I don't know whether this is true of everywhere in America. I can only speak for my affluent, you know, community in Connecticut. But the entire school system here is predicated on the notion that women don't work. And I was speaking to somebody who's still got little ones in grade school the other day, and she was saying this time of year, there are events every single day that the mothers are expected to attend. And I find that shocking and wrong, actually, because the mothers who can't be there, the mothers who are working, whether it's by choice or necessity, there is nothing worse for their children than their mothers not being in school. And I think it's really appalling that happens at the end of the year, that there are classroom events every day that the parents are expected to attend. So I think I don't feel guilt now. My children, the youngest of my children are 16, so they're teenagers and they're very self-sufficient and very independent. But I definitely remember feeling guilt when I was younger, and feeling annoyed that I was being made to feel guilty, because my child would be suffering if I was the only mother that didn't show up. So that was always hard, coordinating book tours and end of school.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. I'll go back to my articles that I'm reading again, but there was an article I know in the Sunday New York Times that I was reading a few weeks ago that was talking about how men and women are both going to school. Maybe they're both graduating with master's degrees and beyond, and they're going into the workforce. If they marry their peer, typically the woman, when they start a family, I came out of private equity in Wall Street, so you were required to work what they call the 50-plus week and be available to travel and really dedicate yourself to the firm, so that these families, these young men and women who are getting married and want to start families, are having to make choices about who will stay home with the kids still. So many of these women are very successful, very talented, and they love their families and want to stay home, but they're also forfeiting their careers and to some extent their husbands to go out in the workforce and do the old school hunting and bring home the money while they can stay home with their kids. So it's funny how things change and don't change.
Yeah, although I see a changing paradigm that I've been witnessing is that more and more men are getting much more involved. They're working from home or working remotely,
right, no
and
doubt.
Are much more involved in the running of the household. And I have to be honest, my husband is home, and I couldn't do what I do without either my husband or a team of people. And luckily I have my husband rather than a team of people. But he does so many of the things that traditionally a housewife would have done. He's the one that picks the children up and takes them to their doctor's appointments. He makes those appointments. He does the household errands, and because I'm working.
Mm. Well, how lucky to have someone so supportive, and that is always the ideal.
Well, what I wanted to do was to have you talk to what it is like in your industry now. So we were talking about how, whether it's movies and television, but books, it seems like everybody's putting a book out, Jane. And do you find that, do you ever get like, you know, I work so freaking hard, I've been doing this for years, I'm good at it, and then just anybody comes out and publishes a book and puts it out there? Do you ever get frustrated with people that they're just able to go and publish a book?
Well, I think the only times I get frustrated are if people don't put, if when people think it's very easy. And I've known people who have not been able to get a book deal. So they self-publish their book and they throw it up on Amazon and it's filled with typos. And, you know, it hasn't been edited. And that's when I get frustrated, because the amount of work that goes into producing a decent book is tremendous. And so I'm frustrated when people do that, because they think it's easy. And yet, it's very rare for those books to sell in any real quantity. Everything is changing. And Amazon... Ultimately, I believe that Amazon is probably going to put everybody else out of business, because I don't see another option. They're able to put out content not only for $4.99 as opposed to a Penguin Random House book that's $24.99, but because of that, people are price driven, so they want the content that's inexpensive, and Amazon are also able to then put your books into all of their promotions. So suddenly your inbox is flooded with promotions, and your book is a Kindle Daily Deal and it's Kindle Unlimited. Amazon has the ability to sell hundreds of thousands of books in a way that the traditional publishers just are not, are only able to do with the handful of books that capture the public's imagination. And that's very rarely from anything the publishers are doing. It's just a book sometimes hits and becomes a huge success. But I think it's very, very hard to compete with Amazon in this day and age. So it's pretty frightening right now. It's a tough business to be in, which is why so many of us are thinking about film and TV and other opportunities and other things that we could be doing.
And even film and TV must be getting tougher, because you put on Netflix, there's tons of material, and some of it's just brilliant and some of it's just sort of, somebody must have just decided they'd make a movie.
That's exactly it. And how do you do something that becomes a breakout rather than just another TV, movie?
I guess at some point the business machine that is Hollywood or whatever, the publishers must find their go-to people. And I think that we may be speaking with one of them, Jane Green, who's just success after success. And then if they put money behind it and talent and resources, that must really just catapult those particular people to the top, and so that they break away from the pack. It's sort of like that 1% mentality, but they keep investing in it.
And there's also an ingredient of just magic that you can't predict. So, there have been countless, certainly with books, but there have been countless projects where I've seen people have expected it to be huge, and people have put enormous amounts of money into it and backing, and it just doesn't necessarily hit. In many ways it's a little unpredictable.
You have a big following.
Go ahead. Will come along like, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Go with your sentence.
Yeah, and then something will come along like Big Little Lies, which was a Leanne Moriarty book and a great book that did well, but was picked up by Reese Witherspoon, by her production company, and turned into an amazing TV series. And it was just so beautifully done that it did fantastically. Everybody watched it. Everybody talked about it. And now they've made season two. You have somebody clever making these things that often that goes a very long way.
Yeah, Reese Witherspoon picks up your picks up your book and wants to make it into something on HBO. Then you are going to be but for her messing it up, you're going to be golden because she's there's every starlet in Hollywood is on that show. Who do I see on there? So it was Nicole Kidman. I saw an advertisement for this yesterday, but Big Little Lies is on HBO, but it has every starlet. I want to say
Meryl Streep's coming
Meryl
in for the second
Meryl
season.
Streep. Meryl Streep, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, so for just a few more minutes here, what about, so you have a certain group, right, of following, if you would call it that, that just read every book that you put out? That's a question.
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
I hope so. Yeah.
So when you're writing, you're thinking about, okay, I'm just really going to speak to this target audience that I know is just waits for my next book.
No, not at all. I don't tend to think about my audience. I write the books I need to write and the story I need to tell, and I just hope that my audience comes with me.
Have you ever wanted to do nonfiction? Or have you done nonfiction? Maybe I'm missing it.
I have a column in a magazine in the UK called The Lady, which is the UK's longest running magazine. It was featured in Downton Abbey. Whenever they needed a new lady's maid, they'd go off to the Lady and find somebody through the ads in The Lady. But I have a column in The Lady, and so that's nonfiction, and it's just a slightly ridiculous take on my life in America. And I love it, and I have thought, gosh, I'd love to put those columns together in a nonfiction book. But other than that, I'm not sure that nonfiction, I haven't discovered a story that would be easy to tell.
Okay, because I find myself, as much as I want to read a novel, I find myself going back to nonfiction. The part of me that must be like an accountant and very logical goes back to it. But I do love a brilliant, and there are certain brilliant, you know, novels or something that yours are escapism, right? Is that how you would describe it?
Well, not entirely, because I would say that I write books for real women like us today. So they're not romances, they're not escapism, but they're more a reflection. There is perhaps a slight aspirational quality, but that's more about the relationships and the friendships and the families that I write about. So I always think that when you pick up a novel, you either want it to be a mirror and reflect your own life, or you want it to be a window, a peek into the others' worlds. And I think I achieve a little bit of both. And I'd say it was that rather than escapism.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know where I got that. I thought
that's okay.
Well, I could use an escape sometimes, especially after the news all the time.
Yeah. And sometimes it's nice to, even though that they're real life stories and characters and things that we sometimes go through. Again, it's that kind of strange authenticity of that if we can't be honest with ourselves or we're struggling to look at that, we can dive into these characters that are going through it themselves and be able to relate and get our own insights from it. My takeaway chatting with you, Jane, it's just been lovely. And so I just keep coming back to mother of six, and 21 books on the way and traveling around the world. And that it's like, wow, how does she do this? That she really do have the hustle, and that when something's important to us, we can make the time for it. And at the end of the day, that's what it is. Just make the time for it, you know, structure your life for success. And say, this is when I'm focusing on my work, and this is when I'm focusing on myself, and this is when I'm focusing on my family, so that we can defy obstacles, whether that's just our own inner fear, whether that's society, whether that's motherhood, parenthood, and get out there, hustle, and achieve great success for ourselves and others.
I think that that's absolutely right. And the other thing that I would add to that is that one of the things that I found invaluable, in fact, it's really the key for me, is that every day is punctuated by periods of peacefulness. So whatever it is that I'm doing, however crazed my life may be, there are periods throughout every day where I get to regroup and have quiet time on my own and can just sort of regenerate and carry on. And I think that's absolutely crucial for anybody with a busy life.
We're coming to the ending, but I want to ask you a question. So you have six children, and they're looking at their mom, and what do you hope that they see in you? For you, I'll throw you with that one.
Really?
Yeah, no,
I think resilience, kindness, humility, and those are really the qualities that I have always wanted to impart to my children. I was never a helicopter mom. I've been very old-fashioned, actually, in the way I've raised my children. They've all cooked since the age of Dot, and you know, they're all very self-sufficient. But I never cared about their academic achievements. I never got involved in school. What I cared about was that they were good people in the world, that they had good manners, that they were aware of the impact that they had on the world around them, that they were respectful and kind, and that they are resilient. And of course, the irony is that they're, you know, going to great schools and you know, things that other people hope for. I never cared. And because I've raised, I think, good children and good people, they've ended up finding the right path for them. And that's always the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. How beautiful.
That is admirable. In today's world where people are trying to do things with their children to force them to be better people,
you went
right to the source of it and didn't force. So I think first of all, thank you very, very much for coming on Defy and Hustle Radio with us today. And I think you are a phenomenal guest. I wish you the absolute best with your most recent book, The Friends We Keep, with the upcoming book and hopefully everything, the screenplay, and I look forward to whatever comes out of that. I wish you the best with your roadshow. And we're here for you whenever you want. You have something you want to promote, we're here for you. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jane Green, everybody.
Thank you, Jane.
Take care, audience. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye, Jane.